The idea is that you can apply this framework to any problem. And the reason I like it is because I think we're just so quick to jump to the ideal situation. We give ourselves so much credit.
We do.
And we skip over the details and rob ourselves of imagining a world where the ideal choice isn't one that's available to us. So like in financial situations, we'll say things like, oh, worst case scenario, I'll just sell the house. Right? If I lose my job, worst case scenario, I'll just sell the house. And it's like, well, what if you can't sell the house? What if the other person on the mortgage is incapable of signing the paperwork or refuses to do that? Then what do you do? Welcome to the Rich and Regular podcast presented by Success, where we explore life at the intersection of money. I'm Kirsten.
And I'm Julian. Today, we're talking about imagining your worst case scenario. Yeah. So let's be clear right off the top. This is not an apocalyptic episode. We're not talking about the end of times or the last days. So you can just relax. Kind of.
I was hoping we'd talk about zombies.
We're not talking about zombies. This is not. Zombies are pretty cool. Mm. But we're not talking about that. This is about like the sudden dreaded loss of income or like job loss when it comes hard and it comes fast and you are scared, and it just seems like the world is kind of falling apart. So if we really wanted to zoom in on that moment, and I know we're still in a pandemic, and so we're probably all reeling from what felt like a pretty weird time, but let's kind of look on the brighter side and think about what 2020 has really taught us. And I think for a lot of people is that 2020 taught us that anything could happen. And I'm not suggesting or projecting that we're going to experience another pandemic anytime soon. I have no idea whether or not that's going to happen. But I do think it at least helps some of us realize that, whoa, I probably need to do a better job of staying ready so that if, or rather when something happens, I'm a little bit more prepared for it.
Yeah.
Completely random note, though. As I was jotting down some notes for this conversation, there are so many words or phrases to describe getting fired. I've jotted down a couple. I think I got all of them. There's downsized, which is like the softer, gentler version.
Downsized. Sounds there's, like you're shrinking.
There's fired, which, you know, made popular
aggressive.
By. Yeah, absolutely. You've got cut loose.
Oh, which sounds also, like dancing.
It does. That's almost
cut
like cut a rug or yeah. cut loose. There's shit canned.
I've never heard that.
You've never heard shit canned?
No.
Really?
What region of the country do they
this
say that?
This might be a North New York thing, shit canned. Yeah. There's axed. Someone gets
also
axed.
Also violent.
Which I will also say as a New Yorker, that's kind of how we say asked. Mm. We just say axed. It's the same thing.
I think that's a black thing in general.
Oh, okay. Maybe. Yeah. That's all I could come up with.
Well, there's let go. Shout out to Frozen.
Yes.
There's terminated.
Terminated.
Yeah.
That's a technical term.
Terminated.
But that makes me think of
violence.
Schwarzenegger.
Yeah. I think my favorite is laid off. Like it just sounds
like the,
strategic.
The Charmin
gentle.
Version of
like
being
I'm just
fired.
Laid off in the sun.
Have you ever been fired?
No. I've had to fire people though. It's heartbreaking.
Yeah.
I hated it. That was the hardest part of my HR job was firing people.
Yeah. I've never been fired. I know people who have been. I've seen it happen. I've watched it go down. In one case, it was very much like you see on television.
Yeah.
You just randomly see someone with a box and they're being escorted out by security. And it's kind of weird, man. It's
yeah, when people are
feeling.
Super calm about it, I'm always like, did you already know that was going to happen? Or are you just naturally a stoic?
Yeah, it's weird. And it's never happened to me, but I can't wrap my head around. I mean, obviously, there are cases and circumstances where these things happen, but I do think there are some people who, for some reason, are just oblivious
to the red flags.
To the red flags, yeah. So I actually did a little bit of digging around, and I found an article on Indeed.com, which is the popular job site, and they listed 11 signs that you may be getting laid off. 11 signs. I'm sure there are more, but they identified 11. Number one, you receive more than one negative performance review.
Yeah.
That makes sense. Mm-hmm. Two, you suddenly start getting left out.
Oh, man.
Yeah.
It's like high school.
Yeah, I know. Everyone's at lunch and you're just standing around.
Was there a meeting?
There was a meeting. There was a big meeting. Your job seems to get more difficult.
That one
I don't quite understand. It just kind of depends on the nature of the business.
Right.
Four, you've received several warnings from your manager. Mm. That
my
one
grandmama
makes sense.
Says, God hits you with pebbles before he hits you with a rock. Those are the pebbles.
Mm, warnings or pebbles.
Yeah.
Okay, grandma.
Don't talk about my grandmama. Well, okay.
I'll pick up the book at the library and see what else, what are the jewels she has in there. The relationship with your boss changes.
Mm.
That one I kind of understand. Number six, you are asked to provide detailed expenses or time reports.
Ooh.
Expenses, I can't wrap my head around. I'd like to think all expenses are pretty detailed.
It just depends. Like, there are some, you know how companies have like excessive food and beverage policies? Like, the policy doesn't explicitly say what is excessive.
Yeah.
But you turn in them receipts, it's like, how many people were there?
Yeah.
And who? And what were y'all talking about?
It was just Nobu.
Right.
Just casual lunch. 5-star sushi. Let's see. Number seven, fewer projects are assigned to you.
Mm.
Number eight, you experience a more critical eye or no feedback at all.
Oh, that's
that
the worst.
No feedback is probably the worst. Number nine, you've been asked to take time off or receive a demotion. I can't even imagine being asked to take time off.
Why don't you stay home today?
Wow. Number 10, you get placed on a performance improvement plan.
Yes, I remember those.
I remember those. And number 11, a merger is taking place, which
that's
is always
a, big one. Yeah.
A sign that, hey, we don't need two people to do the same thing. So those are 11 signs, according to Indeed.com, that you might be getting laid off. So if you're experiencing any of those, don't freak out. But we can talk about what you can do to prepare, but I would always say make sure you get your coins right, protect your finances. But all jokes aside, it's a pretty terrifying moment for a lot of people, especially when you don't anticipate it, and it can lead to a lot of financial instability. So that's why we're talking about it.
Yeah, having your income taken away in an instant absolutely changes your perspective.
Mm-hmm.
It changes what they call the psychological safety that you have around work. And like most tragic loss, traumatic loss, we rarely talk about it, despite how often it actually happens. And the pandemic has completely skewed all the research that was done pre-pandemic. But even pre-pandemic, we were at a point where enough research had been done where you could sort of imagine the future mathematically, meaning there are probabilities in data that exist that allow you to kind of calculate the likelihood of something happening.
Oh, wow.
So there was evidence of income volatility even before the pandemic. There was this study that showed between 1970 and 2002, which is about 30 years, which is roughly a generation, the probability that a working age American would unexpectedly lose at least half of their family income had more than doubled.
Wow.
Yeah. And the report says that household income can change over time for two primary reasons. The first one is the one that we typically talk about. It's economic change, and this is changes in wages, hours worked, or other types of income like public assistance or child support. And the second one was a change in household composition. So things like a job loss that cause a breakup, or the addition of another person to the household, which may reduce employment, like if you have a child or a disabled adult that needs caregiving, and they enter the household. And lastly, people leaving or entering the household could change the household's eligibility for certain types of public assistance benefits. So if you had someone who was receiving benefits and that person passed away or moved out, that lowers your chance of income. Sorry, that lowers your income opportunity for your household.
I can only imagine just how, I'm not even going to say difficult, just impossible it is.
It is.
To predict.
It is. I've been reading a lot about the policies for people with disabilities and how constrained they are to seek out more income because it affects their assistance, their government assistance, which isn't much to begin with.
Yeah.
We actually did an episode on adjusting your financial plan when life happens, and it doesn't address all of these scenarios. Maybe we'll bring on a guest that can help us kind of go through all of the scenarios that this could happen in. It speaks to some changes in household composition, divorce, death, bringing a child into the house. But I think one of the things that people tend to sandbag on most is anticipating economic change.
Yeah.
With household composition change or, you know, those types of situations, there are a lot of support groups and communities that can help you and programs. But with economic change, we just tend to be overly optimistic about how long things are going to be good.
I'm slowly learning that is very much a classic American trait.
Yeah.
Optimism. We're very optimistic people, which I think even when you say it, and when you listen to that, you sound like, yeah, it's a good thing. But there's a consequence to what are they calling it now? Toxic positivity.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's a consequence to that. Speaking as a self-proclaimed pessimist.
Yeah. I mean, one of those consequences is a lack of empathy.
Yeah.
So if you came up in a time where everything was constantly getting better, so say you're, not to generalize boomers, but boomers came of age at a time where there was tons of economic prosperity, it's very hard for them to imagine a world where Gen Xers and millennials have now lived through three financial crises and more on the way.
Yeah. And it's a really interesting segue because, quite honestly, not to pick on them, but they were the first group that came to mind as we were talking about that, because as I think they were the people or the generation that kind of raised us and sort of ushered us into the workforce while we were there. And they were very optimistic. They were also very loyal. They were way more loyal. And I remember this was in the early days of millennial bashing. And they were basically saying that we were the antithesis
of job loyalty. Hoppers.
We were job hoppers. We were just expecting everything to be given to us. And we were useless without our technology. And now here we are 10 years later. And all of these things are pretty much the norm for the most part. But to that point, I found some research that basically validated parts of what we were saying in terms of loyalty. And the key point is that loyalty really doesn't pay anymore. I think there was a time, there was a day, an era, if you will, where your loyalty was certainly much more valuable. And so,
and you're talking about company loyalty.
Company loyalty, job loyalty, this idea of being, you know, the person that absolutely loves their company and, you know, they're the first one there and last one out. And that's the sort of thing that helps to separate you from the rest. And you are essentially rewarded financially and through job security. Like that, as a cultural component, I think, in work culture today, exists, but it isn't.
It's in pockets.
It's in pockets. It's like industry specific.
It is.
It's like, yeah, it's really, really weird. But I found this article, Forbes article, and it basically revealed that for the 20 years from 1992 to 2002, an additional tenure, or I'm sorry. So I found this article from Forbes, and it basically said that for the 20 years from 1992 to 2002, an additional year of tenure garnered about a 1.5% increase in wages per year. So you could argue that's like the value of your loyalty. You stay here and you hang on, you're going to be rewarded with 1.5% on average, according to this data. But by the 2010s, they could measure that same sort of return on your loyalty, and that had fell by almost half to about 0.8%. And if you think about it, that's right about when we started, you know, working at a higher level and to our point about imagining or feeling like things were changing. And if we're being completely transparent, as we were coming up, we were pretty much aware of the fact that we were replacing older workers. Like some of the hiring managers were kind of using softer language around, oh, we are charting a new course and taking this organization and this team on a new level. So we've experienced that in person and in some ways benefited from that. But we're mindful of it now and thinking about, hey, like our time may come as well. So we need to plan and prepare accordingly. But anyway, if we're looking at the numbers, I mean, that 1.5%, if you think about inflation, like that's pretty much nothing. What you're basically saying is that loyalty is not rewarded in terms of pay. You might be in terms of job security and comfort levels, but it certainly is not and has not been rewarded once you factor in inflation over time.
Yeah, and that 1.5% was in 2002. I mean, it dipped in 2010, and I'm sure it dipped again in 2020.
Yes.
And I bet the dips affect I'm sorry, I bet the dips change based on your demographic group. Some people are more vulnerable than others.
Yes, yes. And again, it's older workers. And quite honestly, we know several of these people. We have people like this in our family. I think many of the people that are listening have watched their family members go through this. And so here's essentially what the data is showing. So to your point, the same study showed that half of the workers between ages of 55 and 64 did not get a pay increase in the previous 12 months.
Wow.
And then workers older than that, 65 to 73, as you might expect, fared even worse. So nearly 3 in 5 didn't receive a pay increase at all, right?
Wow.
And let's just be transparent. I remember your mom kind of going through something like
this.
Did. That was
she
part of what really ticked her off. She felt like she was slowly being pushed out, and she felt like she deserved a pay raise, or she deserved accolades. It triggered like feelings of disrespect and all of these things. I remember talking about this for a really long time.
For years
before she finally said, you know what? I'm done. I'm over this. I'm going to go off and live my life.
Yeah. So of those 11 signs that we covered that you're likely to be let go or laid off, I think she probably hit 9 or 10 of them in a 4-year period because things were that bad at her job.
Yeah. And that's not to, you know, make light of the situation. But I mean, I think naturally, it's almost like a natural progression, right? People age out of things, different skill sets become more valuable, jobs become more competitive, more demanding, and you can either keep up or you can't. And so naturally, those who can will reap the benefit, and those who can't sort of get priced out and unfortunately pushed out. Pushed out, that's another one.
Oh, yeah, that's a good one.
Yeah.
Still aggressive.
It is.
But we obviously have a soft spot for older people. We've heard us talk about our parents over and over again on this podcast if you listen often. And what we've realized in our conversations with them is that the reason they find themselves stuck and kind of engaging in these shame spirals is because they try to make the money back the same way they lost it or in the same place that they lost it. So they go and look for more traditional employment because that's what they know. And our latest course in Success Achievers talks a lot about establishing an income portfolio from diverse sources because of this fact. In today's world, being able to establish income streams that aren't reliant on an employer is really a superpower.
It really is.
If you are losing money through wages, whether it's real or just mathematically sound because of inflation rates and the growth rates, going back and looking for that to be different is not a great use of your time. Occasionally it can happen, but it's no different than people who lose $100 at a poker game and then try to make the $100 back by playing another poker game.
Yeah. And I'll tell you what, there's also nothing, but it's also pretty frustrating when you really try hard for that promotion. You feel good about it.
Yeah.
You feel like you did everything right. You took all the classes, you got a certificate, you showed up on time, you probably knocked it out the park, but something as simple as a budget restraint or a failed hire before that basically ate up all the budget takes away any amount of money that might have been set aside for pay increases. And you basically end up with a pat on the back, a promise, and a go get them again next year.
Yeah.
You know, we try again. That can be pretty tough to deal with.
Yeah, you get tired of trying out for the team. It's
At
what point do I get to get the uniform and actually suit up? So we talked about the older demographic. Another demographic that's affected by income volatility is married couples or two-income households.
Yep.
So this is an interesting one because it's kind of unexpected. You would think that two incomes is like an automatic advantage. I love when we like speak to groups about financial independence and someone always asks like, can you achieve FI if you're single? And I'm always like, hell yes. Like getting married is not a race.
Right.
Achieving financial independence might actually be easier if you're single because you presumably have less expenses.
Yeah.
But this phenomena of two income households being more likely to be negatively impacted by income volatility is something that Elizabeth Warren talked about in The Two Income Trap, which is a book she wrote with her daughter. Did you ever read that?
No, that's exactly where I was going with this, though. So I've never read it, admittedly. And in a weird way, it's one of those books I kind of feel like I don't have to read because I already know what she's going to say.
You already know the plot.
I recommend the book as if I read it. I can speak to the book because we've read so many other books that have referred to it. And we've been to so many programs and seminars and they've all referred to it. So get the book. We highly recommend it, especially if you find this sort of stuff interesting. But the premise of the book is that a considerable amount of middle income households are going broke because they built unsustainable lifestyles that require them to earn two incomes. And not just that, they've built this lifestyle that requires them to earn two incomes at the same or at a higher level for the foreseeable future. This is that optimism again, right? So if we're making $100,000 or $200,000 this year, maybe more, it doesn't matter. We have a tendency to believe that that's the new floor.
Yeah.
You will never earn less than this.
So you take out a mortgage that requires 30 years to pay off, assuming that you're going to stay at the same income level.
Correct. This is where that blind optimism or willful optimism comes from, right? Mm-hmm. We just believe it and we say, yep, I'm good. She's good or he's good. And we're going to hang on and we're going to do this for the foreseeable future with no hiccups. And the reality is the data, as we've sort of shared, reflects otherwise. The likelihood of a disruption significantly higher.
Yep.
And as you get older, the likelihood of a disruption is even higher. So this idea of catching up in your later years, this is why people aren't really able to do that. And this is why it pays to be a little bit pessimistic, because the reality is anything can happen. Illnesses, injuries from an accident, a merger, a sick family member, a housing fire, like all of these things are horrific and terrifying to think about. But there's a financial layer to it as well. And you can have insurance, but even with insurance, these things can be financially devastating and almost impossible to climb out of.
Difficult. Almost impossible is good if you haven't prepared. But if you have prepared, it's just difficult.
Difficult. Okay. I appreciate your optimism.
It's a habit I can't break. But Tim Ferriss coined a term called practical pessimism, which he learned from Greek Stoics and philosophers. So it's really their thing and not his thing, but he coined the term. So I'm gonna credit him. But the idea is that you practice pessimism by considering in full detail the worst case scenario, or in his words, you define the nightmare. So the way he explains it is almost like an antidote to that Mike Tyson quote. Everybody has a plan till they get punched in the face. Is that how it goes?
Yeah.
Yeah. So this is almost like a counter to that. Tim and the Roman Stoics want you to visualize that punch in loving detail.
I feel like you're giving people license to strike their partners.
What? No. Visualize the punch.
Oh, okay.
So in this scenario, you would take a piece of paper and create three columns. So in the first column, you would list everything bad that could happen if you were punched. You could lose a tooth, you could break a jaw, whatever. In the second column, you do it in detail. I see, y'all should see the
That's
way Julian's looking at
list.
Me. You could have a concussion. Yeah. You make a long list of all the bad things that could happen if you were punched in the face in the first column. In the second column, you're going to write down all the ways that you can minimize each of those results. So you can check your footwork. You can put your head, put your hand
you
up.
You cannot get in the ring with Mike Tyson.
You cannot get in the ring with Mike Tyson. Don't pick no fights.
Okay.
Don't write no checks that your ass can't count. That's another grandma saying. Or you can duck. These are all the things that you can do to minimize the likelihood that the things in column one happen.
Okay.
All right. So then in the last column, you list all the ways that you could recover from each setback if it were to happen. So in column two, you've just wrote down how you can mitigate the risk. But in column three is like, well, if it happens, here's how I recover. So this thing would be, these things would be like, I'd go to the dentist. I'd get an ice pack. I'd buy some new teeth. I'd drink Boost for breakfast. Ensure for dessert. Kanye West lyric. Never mind. But anyway.
Insert crickets.
I know.
Sound right here.
But the idea is that you can apply this framework to any problem. And the reason I like it is because I think we're just so quick to jump to the ideal situation. We give ourselves so much credit.
We do.
And we skip over the details and rob ourselves of imagining a world where the ideal choice isn't one that's available to us. So like in financial situations, we'll say things like, oh, worst case scenario, I'll just sell the house. Right. If I lose my job, worst case scenario, I'll just sell the house. And it's like, well, what if you can't sell the house? What if the other person on the mortgage is incapable of signing the paperwork or refuses to do that? Then what do you do? Like, that's the benefit of going through this exercise, especially that third column, because it helps you think of like all the ways that you can recover from your worst case scenarios.
Have you created your three columns?
I have, but it's always over what I...
The most optimistic worst case scenario. It's like, what if someone steps on my foot? Oh, no.
I tend to do it on small things. Like, I have not admittedly done it for, like, the major life things. But I do it in terms of, like, well, what if someone, you know, leaves a rude comment? Or what if I go viral for the wrong thing? Or what if I, you know... Who knows?
Wow. God forbid you go viral.
It's for the wrong thing.
For the wrong thing.
Isn't that crazy?
There's no such thing as the wrong thing.
If you go viral. You know how people like film you when you don't know they're filming you and you could be like picking a wedgie or, you know, having a moment, crying in a restaurant and all of a sudden you're on Twitter or a Tinder. I mean, not Tinder, TikTok.
Picking a wedgie.
Picking a wedgie.
Yeah.
Or it's just your wedgie and it's a meme. Like, you could be memed.
Yeah. Yeah.
I've created columns around being memed.
Okay.
Anyway. Bring
so
it back.
That's a pretty funny worst case scenario. One can imagine your life is pretty good if the worst thing that ever happens to you is you go viral for picking out your wedgie. But I will say, in terms of just kind of preparing and thinking about how to recover from any of these anticipated or, you know, not necessarily hypothetical, but any of these types of situations. I love it. I really love that exercise. And again, it comes a little easier for me because I'm a bit more of a pessimist than most. I am open to that. I admit that. But I will also say this is one of the reasons why I love our brokerage account. And in the money and personal finance world, I really wish the brokerage account got more respect and more love for what it served. There's so much love to the Roth IRA and HSAs and 401ks for all of their tax benefits. And that's great. You're absolutely right. But there is a lot of power in having a brokerage account, which is basically another portfolio very similar to your IRA and your 401k. But you own it, right? And it's post-tax. So it's right there. You can access it. You don't have to worry about any penalties or any of that stuff because you've already paid taxes on that money. It's like a secondary checking account that's kind of growing. And again, not that you would actually use it like a checking account, right, but you can sit there and watch it grow and keep contributing to it. I just found that to be, at least at this point in my life, one of the most valuable accounts that are out there to have, in addition to an emergency fund, a checking, and a savings account. Because at the end of the day, when a crisis hits, you want to have as many options available to you as possible. Like, mm-hmm. to me, that's one of the things that really increases the likelihood of your ability to recover. The fewer options you have, the more difficult it's going to be. The more options you have, you can buy yourself some time. You can buy yourself some support. You can do a lot more than you could otherwise. So I'm a big, big fan of brokerage accounts for that reason. Now, I will say, in a brokerage account, you're talking about post-tax dollars. If you were to, let's say, sell some of those stocks or whatever it is that you have in that account, you are going to have to pay short and long-term capital gains, but the typical tax rate or the fees associated to that are significantly lower than what you would be paying on your, let's say, W-2 income. So for me, it's like just a really, really great, not necessarily a safety net, but it's like a multi-purpose investment account that mm-hmm. you can use to get yourself out of a pickle or really just to keep stacking and building wealth.
Yes, I'm a big fan of leveraging financial tools and accounts to help you think through how you would recover from any sort of setback. I think another way, if you're not interested in an investment account, to help practice and prepare for your worst case scenarios is actually to participate in some of those social challenges. They seem silly at the time, but participating in like a no spend month or one of those 52 week savings challenges where you basically increase your savings every week. So in week one, you save $1, week 10, you save $10, and so on and so on until you have $1,300, over $1,300 saved by the end of the year. All of those are good reminders that, one, discretionary expenses are discretionary, or more importantly, optional. You do not have to have everything on your discretionary expense list. And two, and more importantly, these short-term challenges can spark long-term lifestyle changes, like learning to live below your means.
Learning to live.
Long-term lifestyle, learning to live below your means.
Did your grandmother say that one too? I love living below my means.
Do you?
I do.
I do. Too.
You know what? I'm not going to say it feels good, but the result of it feels really, really good.
I wish it was called something else.
Yeah.
Like living below your means.
I think that's a biblical term.
Is it biblical?
I'm sure it
feels biblical.
Yeah. That's why I thought your grandmother made it up.
My grandmother was not Jesus, well, for the record.
They went to high school.
Her name is Mary. So
see, they're friends. But no, living below your means. This is one. It's a topic of conversation. It gets lots of attention. People throw around that term all the time. But I will say it's a really, really powerful concept. I think what's really interesting to me is the number of people who undervalue how powerful just that simple act can be. So they undervalue the importance of living below your means, but they overvalue things like job security or the marketability of their particular skills because they're so smart or talented at what they do. Or even just from an emotional standpoint, we overvalue our resilience, our ability to take whatever is thrown at us. When the reality is, at different points in our life, depending on what's happening, you may not be nearly as strong as you used to be. And sometimes you want to have a safety net or an extra cushion or an extra account or something that you can tap into to fall back on to really help get yourself out of a scary situation. Before the pandemic, like shortly after we met, like I would say that was the cornerstone of what we were doing. I mean, obviously we were investing at a high rate. At our peak, we were investing 70% of our income. But that was a deliberate decision for us to live below our means because we'd agreed to not be so optimistic. We knew that we were doing well. We knew that we were earning a above average amount of income. But we also looked up and said, you know what? I don't know that I want to be my boss or my boss's boss, or that I even have the energy to do that. I mean, they were traveling all over the world, and you know, maybe the first couple of months it looked exotic, but after a while it was like, man, that is probably really, really exhausting. What are some ways where we can, let's say, get the benefit of that income but not have to do all of the other things that really just kind of exhaust us? So all that to say, I'm a big, big fan of living below your means because it gives you the tools and the seeds that you need to sort of plant for the future, and then gives you that much more flexibility when you need it.
Yeah, I remember when everything shut down. I mean, of course, we were anxious and worried like everyone else, but lifestyle-wise, because we had already experienced a lifestyle that consisted of eating at home, working out at home, not spending a ton on clothes and travel, it was kind of like riding a bike. Yeah. And we, you know, we had basically practiced pessimistic pandemic life and social distancing before it was a public health issue. And it just proves that some knowledge is experiential. You need to live it and know it to believe that that kind of savings rate is possible for you.
Yeah. Yeah. Savings rates is another one. You know, we talked about being able to save upwards of 70%. I think on average, we were closer to like 40 to 50, but there was that one year we hit around 70%. And now we're at the point where I don't even think about savings rates anymore. I mean, I have a set number. I want to save X amount of dollars this year. And it's, you know, maybe a percentage of my income. It may be in excess of my income.
Right.
But that's truly a privilege and a benefit that we have earned over the years. And, you know, living below your means, being practical pessimists, being aggressive savers and investors.
All right.
All right.
Final thoughts.
Final thoughts. Well, you know, you go first.
All right. My final thought is practicing pessimism isn't an all or nothing activity. You don't have to identify as a pessimist to practice pessimism. And you can be pessimistic about outcomes, but optimistic about your ability to get through them. And just because you decide to be pessimistic about an outcome, it doesn't have to make you cynical or skeptical of everybody involved. Mm. Meaning you don't have to hate your partner or your hiring manager or an HR professional just because you understand the odds of income volatility in your lifetime. The story of how the American labor model impacts our economy is a nuanced one, and your ability to embrace that gives you a competitive advantage.
I love that.
It was very diplomatic, wasn't it?
Yeah, I'm trying to think of who you were channeling just now. It might have been Elizabeth Warren or something.
Oh, that's such a compliment.
Oh, good.
Yeah, I love Liz.
All right, my final thoughts are employers. They have every incentive to recruit and retain you as a worker, especially if you do good work. They may even pay you competitively for the value of the work that you provide. But you owe it to yourself to look at the bigger picture. And the reality is over half of Americans today don't have enough saved for their retirement. And it's common for people to think that they can catch up on their retirement contributions. We all know someone that says, it's fine, I'll make up for it next year. But that year never comes. Mm-hmm. And even if that year does come, they don't have the income at the same level that they did. Or someone else gets sick. Or the car gets busted. Or a roof leaks or something like that. There's always going to be something. And it's about time we just kind of prepare and expect for those things to happen, as opposed to always looking on the brighter side. Mm. It's okay to hope for the best. But if 2020 has taught us anything, it's that there's value in preparing for the worst.
Wow. Profound.
Thank you.
Well, thank you for listening to another episode of the Rich and Regular podcast presented by Success. If you want to practice pessimism, don't start in the reviews. Start by leaving us a 5-star rating and review if you like what you heard. We'll see y'all next week.